In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, under the weather, but we got to deliver. Always time to make the donuts. We got a good one. It's part one of a two-part talk with Jeff Parker. We'll be discussing Thunderbolts, the Hulk, of course we mean the General Haross Red Hulk, a webcomics project Jeff has coming up, and our first edition of the Word Balloon Hotline. That's right, your questions. Thank you very much to those who have participated. You'll hear the first batch of calls and how to join in on the conversation of Word Balloon. It's all brought to you today by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. A great selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, all at 38% or more off the standard retail price, depending on the publisher. Sometimes up to 50% off the standard retail price. Don't forget, your orders of $50 or more receive free shipping at InStockTrades.com. And we talk a lot about Jeff Parker books today. There's a lot available at InStock Trades, several pages of them. How about the first volume of X-Men First Class? Jeff was the original writer of that series. The standard retail price, $24.99 at InStockTrades.com. $15.49 for the hardcover. We here at War Balloon have been big fans of the Agents of Atlas and other iterations of Atlas written by Jeff for Marvel. You can get the first trade paperback. The standard retail price is $24.99. Again, at InStockTrades.com, $15.49. There's Jeff's great collaboration with Tom Follow, Mysterious the Unfathomable, from Wildstorm. The original trade paperback price was $17.99. At InStockTrades.com, $11.15. Check out all the deals that are waiting for you at InStockTrades.com.
Say a few syllables. That's one.
There's two. No, I was going to do some South Pacific, and then suddenly it all went out of my head. There is nothing like a day.
I did that in junior high.
In the world. What part were you?
I was Ray Walston, Luther, whatever his name was.
Really?
Yes,
nice.
I was.
Good part.
Yes, I was. I love that musical. He was quite the music man.
It's a great musical. It's on my brain because my daughter wants to listen to it all the time right now, so we're playing it all the time. And,
oh, my God.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because then you realize how much Alf Clausen goes to them, for Rodgers and Hammerstein, for when doing his musical takeoffs on The Simpsons.
Sure.
It's like he just goes... because they're a never-ending well of good stuff.
Oh, my God. Those CDs are fantastic. Absolutely. You really do appreciate how good that music is. Mm-hmm. Do you have the Picnic Basket, the Hanna-Barbera music?
I don't.
That's really cool.
Someone did, but I don't have it.
And Hoyt, first name Hoyt. I cannot remember the guy's last name.
All I can think of is Hoyt Axton.
It's Hoyt Kirk.
The devil in the dealer and a dog named Jake and a cat named Kalamazoo.
And, of course, the dad in Gremlins.
He's from the WKRP episode where we're supposed to believe that Lonnie Anderson was always had a big thing for this big oafish country singer.
Well, I guess he married her when she was like 16 or something. I remember that episode. Come on, man.
Yeah, it's like, that's the thing. That's when they suddenly decided that she was from a small country town.
That's right.
And, that was her background.
I got to tell you, Hoyt Axton, very sorry he's dead because he was very funny.
So was the Axton estate. Yeah.
And he was great on that episode. He was awesome in Gremlins.
True.
I mean, that's the thing. I could really have enjoyed like a Hoyt Axton in genre fiction, like popping up in like Asylum sci-fi movies and stuff like that.
What this world needs, John, is a new Hoyt Axton.
No, I'm very content with the old one. No, I understand. He was like Barry Corbin. You know what I'm saying?
God, yeah. Oh, Barry Corbin's brilliant.
You know, and that's the thing. Like, and every now when I see Barry Corbin, like he'll pop up in No Country and stuff like that, and it's like, oh, thank God he's still alive. Because it's like it seems like after Northern Exposure, he just kind of disappeared.
I accidentally got him a job one time.
Doing animation?
I was working on for Westwood Video. I was doing the storyboards for the live action bits in between, and I'm sitting down with the director, and they're trying to figure out. It's like we're going to call some. We got to call some people. We haven't picked out who will play the general in this thing. And I think I said something, you need like a Barry Corbin type. And then he goes, we've worked with him before. He was really good. And he goes back looking through. And I swear by the end of the day, they had confirmed Barry Corbin. And Barry Corbin doesn't even know that I got him a few thousand bucks because I was just sitting around in a room in Las Vegas shooting my mouth off or whatever. And next thing I know, he's in there shooting all those scenes. I come back a few months later, he shot them all. And it's like, it's really fun to watch. Gabe Hartman would be a better person to talk to about it, but because he sees it all the time. But, after you've laid this whole thing out and you just sort of pictured this actor, and then you come back and went, yep, that's exactly how I thought he'd do that. And, that's kind of neat.
Very cool. I'm talking to Gabe in a few days because Gabe was another guy I reached out to here at the end of the year.
He's a good interview.
I'm well aware. Well, that's the thing. I felt bad. Like, the last time I had both of you on, and I'm happy to do it again because, I got a great response from it, and, B, I enjoy having you both on. But I also want to give you guys, your own time as well.
Yeah, you don't want me stepping all over. Gabe's got real things to say. You don't want to hear me going, blah, blah, blah.
Well, first of all, Parker,
I'm so great, and Gabe, did you have something to say? Good. No.
No, yeah. That's not true. And also, this is why we're talking now, because it's been...
No, he deserves his own show. Because,
right. Well,
he's got a lot of good insights.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You both do. I mean, I'm glad to have you back. It's good to have you back.
I like our new Christmas tradition of it. Like, after Christmas, we wrap up the year by trying to puzzle it all out.
Did we do that last year? Did we also do this?
I think we've been doing it at the end of the year every time.
Yeah. That's very cool. Well, no, that's good. That's funny because I know I talked to Celia at the end of last year, too. So that's good. You guys are my go-to guys. But no, honestly, I think you've had a very interesting year, and there's been so much stuff that has happened to you since we last talked. It was at the start of the last Atlas arc that we last spoke, and I want to start with that just because among others that really enjoyed the series, I'm very sorry that it went, but I also think you got a real opportunity to kind of wrap up the story, put it in a good place, and you packed so much story in those, seven issues, was it?
Actually, it's just...
Or it was five, but it was seven parts that you, smushed into the five issues?
Yeah, I tried to really... there's a precedent established for that with Atlas, because in the first, the very first miniseries, when Marvel was putting all of its money and all attention on Civil War, and we're essentially just, I guess we've got a little money left. Sure, here, you guys do whatever you're trying to do over here. We're not going to pay very much attention. And we didn't even have the budget to do a full 22 pages. So if you go back and look at those, they're only 21 pages long until the last one.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I just tried to space everything and compress stuff in a way that you felt like you were, you were getting plenty of story. And I don't want people to think, oh, good, let's go back and look at what he did and save some money by cutting out a page. But, I didn't want the reader to be cheated. So, we've done that before. It comes at the expense of being able to do something like a cool splash here and there that ordinarily I would like to do and let the artist have a little room to just go nuts on a giant visual.
Certainly.
But anyway, so we kind of did that at the end of Atlas, and that was really tough. That was really tough on Gabe because, at the same time, they were all over him to say, like, we got to launch you guys on Hulk and everything. So why don't you just draw everything at once? And
good God,
I don't know how he lived through it, but because he's a freaking machine is why. he just powered through it somehow, and eating only cheese sandwiches to keep him alive, and. So I didn't do a whole lot of splashes or double pagers, except where I could tell a whole lot of story or where it really warranted it. Like, a dragon come in, well, that's got to be a splash. You can't have a dragon just fly in and burn a whole bunch of people to death and not take up a bunch of room on that one. The very last Atlas, and then I tried to even cram you. I did something I'd been wanting to do the whole time where I did part of it in text. And that was just a tribute to the old Atlas comics where they would always get in a two-page prose story. And mainly to, at the time they did it to qualify for magazine shipping rates.
Right.
And so they could say, no, this isn't a comic book. This is a magazine that just has a lot of comic material.
Now give us our 2 cents per issue back on mailing.
Yeah, they cared about that. And, so I wanted to do that, and that helped compress a little bit. And also it worked really well for a part of the scene where it made more sense for you to not see what was happening. And then I tried to take up some slack by actually drawing a section myself. I know that was frustrating for everybody waiting for me to turn pages in because I'm, you know, painfully slow. But so that worked out. You know, Elizabeth Betty Breitweiser saved me on that. She did beautiful colors, and it made me look like I still knew what I was doing. It all came together. And then, bam, somehow Hulk came out right on top of it. And now we're finally getting to where I think I don't know that Gabe's getting a breather, but he's getting to at least get into a normal human schedule.
That's cool.
With a book.
No, understood. And has the Atlas final Atlas hardcover come out at least? I haven't seen it because I did buy all the issues. But
no, I'm trying to think what. Yeah, I don't know when that's going to be. It'll be out sometime.
Okay, good, because it is terrific, and I do recommend that people check it out. And
yeah, Marvel's pretty good about that. They don't make you wait forever for those things.
Well, and again, further, kind of like with Jason Aaron on Ghost Rider and Fraction on Iron Fist and stuff, if they wanted to, and I don't know what the demand is, you really could do, when you step back, you did like 30-some issues of Atlas, didn't you?
Yeah, everybody thinks of it as this little burst. But if you go look at it, we actually had a much bigger run than a lot of people do on a lot of things.
Well, that's what I mean. And I understand it was a struggle crunching the numbers and everything, but you did obviously have a very passionate group of fans that absolutely enjoyed every story. So
yeah.
I understand. And, it's in that weird environment right now, Jeff. And obviously you work in this environment where half the time you're doing tie-ins, also trying to do your own thing, and it's tough when it's a standalone series, obviously, to succeed in what the current marketplace is.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing, if we had come out with that in the 80s, had any of us been good enough to do something like that when we were teenagers, I like to think they would have had a parade for us down Main Street, and, it would have been cherished thing that people still talk about today. Maybe it will be, but in this weird transitional phase the mainstream comics industry is in, it's kind of it's a really hard thing for anything that's not something the main fans grew up with. We kind of tried to trick you a little bit by saying, hey, here's something that was around, but really no one read that as a kid. It's just those characters did happen to have a history, but really not. They weren't used that much, unless you count Jimmy Woo and the Godzilla comic book.
That's
which
right.
I do,
and I do too as well,
because I bought all of those Godzilla comic books.
He's a minor player in Nick Fury versus Shield as well.
Yeah, he's got his special glasses that allow him to see around corners or whatever it was.
Honestly, unsung Al Feldstein genius in Jimmy Woo.
Oh, yeah.
Going all the way back. And I think that we've talked about it before. But, no, I'm a huge Jimmy Woo fan, and I think he's a positive character. And hopefully, in whatever future books you have, maybe, I'm guessing we haven't seen the last of Gorilla Man, just because he is Gorilla Man, for God's sake.
Yeah, it would have a little more weight, though, if it didn't look like my pet project thing where I bring them in. You know, so if someone else would use them, not screw them up, that would be ideal.
Okay.
Or whatever, because if I do it, it's just going to look like, Parker just wants to go back to the ones he already knows how to write in his sleep. And actually, it's not.
Editorially or from a reader standpoint or both?
Probably both, but probably mostly from the reader standpoint. Actually, the editors were always on me more to put Atlas in things more than I was. That they turned up in like a Spider-Man special and all that stuff. That wasn't me. That was completely the editors asking for it. And that's great. I was happy to write it, but people may have the notion that it's me just like I'm constantly going up to editors. Can I put a gorilla and a robot in that? And I really am not.
No, I understand, man. But they
perfect,
are great.
A perfect example is the many different character pitches I kept sending when they asked me to do a Deadpool fill-in for a Deadpool team up.
Thank you for doing those minis, by the way.
And I did not ask for Gorilla Man. The first one I asked for, I think, was first I asked for Wood God, because I always ask for Wood God, and that's just mainly to see, because I know no one's ever going to know who I'm talking about, and then they'll go look it up, and then they'll come back to me with and that's exactly what I got. he's a satyr, and episode, no Wood God, and then I came back and I had a good idea for Blade versus Deadpool, and I wanted that. And they said, no, we're doing Blade and something else.
Oh, that's too bad. That is a Deadpool comic I would read. Go on.
I know. It's the perfect thing. And so anyway, because Deadpool because Blade is being used somewhere else, he's obviously like a living human who can only do one thing at a time. I couldn't use him. And then I can't remember. There were like a couple more, and then finally I just gave up and put it this half-hearted, I don't know, Gorilla Man. Yes! Fine. It's like, if you wanted me to do Gorilla Man in the first place, just say Gorilla Man, and I'll just draw it. I'll just write it, you know. So anyway.
Now, that's interesting, because I kind of thought it was to
and then Steve
support
Sanders
Atlas, and that it was already in the pipeline, and that, okay, fine, it's coming out.
Yeah, you'd think that, but really it's just because I couldn't get Blade. What's wrong with it? Hey, Marvel, what are you afraid of? What do you think I'm going to do with Blade? I was going to do all this cool vampire stuff. It's going to be great.
I trust you.
I better. I actually better hold on to it because you never know.
Let's talk about what's currently going on in terms of Hulk. As you say, that's where you and Gabe have transitioned. And honestly, I really like it because it's, even though it's Ross, just from a visual standpoint, it really reminds me of those early Kirby issues where it really is kind of the horror aspect. And it's just more illustrative. And obviously because of who Gabe is, but just the staging of it reminds me of Kirby kind of poses and stuff.
Oh, I'm trying so hard to make this a modern 60s book, and I think Gabe can't help but make it that. And it's, by the way, I'm going to play a drinking game when you interview Gabe next week. Every time he says Bruno Premiani, I'm going to take a drink. And I'm going to end up just face down on the floor in my own sick.
That would be the Doom Patrol artist, kids, if you're scoring at home.
Yeah. But every time he says Bruno Premiani, everybody's got to take a shot. With good reason, Bruno Premiani was a badass.
Oh, I got that essential. Absolutely, man. Or your showcase.
Those Doom Patrols are so good.
Absolutely.
All the Hulk. Yeah. The interesting thing is this setup with Ross as the Red Hulk kind of gets you back to the very original setup where Hulk was sort of this menace. And when you think about what that was like for the time, Spider-Man even seemed kind of weird for the time. He's crawling on Ross. You know, he's sort of weird. But then the Hulk was probably the first real anti-hero in comics. I could be wrong about that. You know, maybe you can count the Shadow or whoever. Shadow wouldn't have had a proper comic.
Oh, no, he did. They had Shadow comics back in the 40s. Absolutely.
They weren't just big little books that pasted around?
No, they really did. I can't remember who the publisher was, but it might have just been Street and Smith. They might have had a comic division. But there were Doc Savage and Shadow comics. Absolutely, man.
Well, the idea, the way Hulk was presented, he's this monster. And they didn't even play it up as he's constantly mistaken. He actually would do bad things every now and then. And at least, you know, it's kind of tame, you know, compared to what you could have him do. But for the time, that was a very anti-hero and a really interesting way to explore it. And I'm trying to, without just simply just, I'm already standing on the shoulders of giants anyway. And if I don't feel properly guilty about that, trust me, I do. If it doesn't seem like it. But, you know, I'm trying to get the same kind of feeling without just ripping off their stories. But we are doing some things where, like, we kind of put Red Hulk into some of the same classic positions Green Hulk would be in, and then you get to see how it's different with him in it.
Certainly.
And one of the things we've got coming up, once the Scorched Earth storyline wraps up, is going to be we start to introduce a whole bunch of new threats that are all his own villains. You know, it's time for him to quit using everybody else's villains. And frankly, I'm tired of going around from office to office asking if I can have a cup of shocker or whatever. You know, it's like, could I borrow some Dr. Doom for just a moment? It would just be excellent. So I don't want to do that anymore. I'm just making up some new ones. And Gabe's designing the living hell out of them. And we're kind of going to show you some perspectives on, like, how he's going to deal with having his own rogues gallery. And in one case, with a character coming up called Zero One, this is something I've kind of wanted to do for a bit. I think it's going to be interesting where I want the readers to follow along the birth of a new supervillain and kind of see how they start to their own rise. And in a way, I want you to root for the bad guys. And, you know, we kind of did that back with the Alpha thing, where you're following the intelligentsia with MODOK and Leader and Red Ghost and everybody. And I was having fun with trying to strike the balance of, well, yeah, they're the bad guys, but don't you kind of want to see what they can do? It's kind of like a caper flick. And, you know, and in the same way, I'm going to do this, like, hey, here's where the bad guy is coming from. We don't want our hero really to get killed, but don't you kind of want to see how far they can get?
How much they can take, sure.
Who knows? Maybe you'll like them better, and then it'll become the bad guy's book. You know, I just want to try to switch up the dynamics of it a little bit and see what we can achieve.
That's awesome, man. Well, and also, you're right. During Loeb's run, and much like his Superman-Batman run at DC, it was kind of the Red Hulk towards the Marvel Universe that we know. So it would be fun to get some new ideas. But it's interesting because, again, in today's marketplace, I just put together a clip show, and I had Phil Hester, and he was talking about, you know, creating your own heroes for you rather than and villains rather than, you know, doing it for DC and Marvel and stuff. Do you... it was something even that came up on my friends at 11 O'Clock Comics. They were discussing this in terms of, you know, do you want to create a new villain for the Marvel Universe, or do you want to really keep that villain for your own ideas and for your own books and stuff like that? Do you ever think about that, or is it, you know, obviously...
Oh, yeah, I think about it all the time. And my way of thinking is, because I don't want to short people, I don't want to think, well, I'm saving all the sweet action for my own properties, you know? The way I perceive it is, I'm going to create for Marvel something that only really works in Marvel. And I'm going to try my best to make it work really well. Something that, because, you know, I've got a good outsized ego. I want my villains to go out there and be so awesome that everybody wants to use them. Same thing with my heroes.
Sure.
Then if I get these other characters, it's like I am not going to shoehorn some other idea into the Marvel universe that I think is entertaining but really doesn't work in that universe. So it actually divides up pretty naturally. I've got some other things I'm starting to write now and get going that's like they won't work for Marvel, so I'm not going to do them for Marvel. And then pure Marvel stuff, it's like this is going to be gold and I'm all excited about. But it's only going to work as long as you look up and see that little Marvel red banner up there in the corner on the front of the book, because it kind of is designed to fit in that world and with the kind of characters it's going to run into.
Well, I can see that, because I think that's why you were, even though you had short runs there, such a good fit for Exiles. I mean, that's the thing. I think you get Marvel, and I think actually a lot of your assignments, one of the reasons why I think you work well in these spinoff books is because I think they can almost drop you into a Marvel situation and go, okay, write in Marvel speak, write something that fits for this world and everything. And I think you have a good handle on that.
Yeah, so. That reminds me. One of the things you'll see, so it'll have been out by the time, I think it's tomorrow, unless I'm really screwing this up.
I'm putting this on next Tuesday.
One of the backups in Hulk is going to feature a new Watcher. And here's where it's like I really, you know, with Hulk, I'm trying to make its own standalone thing that you don't have to feel obligated to know a whole lot about all the Marvel history and all the Secret Wars and everything like that. I want you to come in and you get the basic premise of him. It's like he's this guy who finally became the thing he hated. You know, it's very mythic in that sense. And you know, he's just kind of on the run and can't be the thing he wanted to be, and he can't be with the people he wanted to be, and now he's got a new start in life, and he's kind of figuring out who he is and smashing things. But on the whole, I don't want it to be, as you'll see, you know, we start to get it away from all the big Marvel trappings, but then in the backup, I'm starting to introduce this new character, and it all has to do with Uatu, who I guess that's how you say his name.
Yes.
The Watcher, the one who constantly comes and cheats. I am forbidden to interfere in this world, but if you happen to look over there behind this planet, you might find, I'm not saying you will, you might find a device that would stop Galactus, maybe. And here, Johnny, I'll create a bubble of air around you as you fly through the universe to find this thing. But I am forbidden to interfere, and I'm totally not helping here. I didn't see any of this. I love the, I've always loved the idea of the Watchers. They're just fascinating.
There was that.
And Hardman draws a great Watcher anyway.
Absolutely. You know that Son of Marvel Origins had a great Watcher story.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the one that always fascinated me and had that real cosmic feel and made me feel like the Watcher was otherworldly beyond his giant head and the fact.
Yeah, with Hulk, I'm getting to, as you'll see, that's going to lead to a very cosmic element in the upcoming story. But at the same time, you'll see a very down to earth, very very street element start to show up soon with another villain, and that's the kind of thing. That's where I'm trying to get into the magic that Kirby did so well. As Paul Tobin said this, he phrased it beautifully one day, and I went, wow, I wish I had been recording you when you said that. He just said, no one could do simpletons and gods better than Kirby. And he's right. It's those two extremes that he excelled at.
Absolutely.
You know, that's why a godlike character or a caveman in the hands of Kirby was just pure gold. It was always going to work.
Or the wise ass from the Newsboy Legion, and I forget his name right now.
Yeah, some little Bowery boy reject who's running around talking like it's 1930 in the late 60s. That's the kind of thing Kirby would do so well. It's so great. So, I mean, you just look at it and you think, man, no one can touch this guy.
Yeah. No.
And I feel like when you're working with Hulk or anything Hulk related, it's a good way to go.
What I like about General Ross as the Hulk, too, is, and he has this attitude, I think, in your books of just, oh, fuck, it's these goddamn superheroes. You know, and he's just, he hates them, and that's what makes him interesting as opposed to just Hulk smash. It's just, oh, Christ. Oh, and I'm sure when he sees the Watcher and stuff, it'll be like, yeah, great. Hi, how you doing? Nice to see you.
Yeah, and you saw him in the one where he goes with the help Thor. They go out into space. They smash these two comets. And then, of course, because he just hit a comet, he's not feeling so hot. And you know, he lands on a meteor, and he's barely alive. And then the Watcher shows up, like the biggest dick in the universe, and says, oh, by the way, you're going into a black hole. I wish I could help, but I'm... That to me was such a joy to write. I love the idea of the Watcher just stepping in and kind of being a dick about it. I'm just here to tell you that I appreciate what's about to happen to you. You're going into a black hole.
And that's exactly. Nobody likes this guy, and that's what's interesting. And also just that it's this senior citizen who's suddenly a hero, you know, or whatever he is now and everything that he has to kind of, all right, this is what I am, and this is the only...
What kind of helped me glom onto that was, you know, I'd see the way Ed McGuinness would draw him when the few times he drew Ross, and he gave him the big beefy forearms, and he looked like a badass.
Absolutely.
And he's like one of these 60-year-old guys who can still kick your ass, and you're kind of hoping, I hope when I'm that old I look like that guy.
Absolutely. And, yeah, he's like Paulie Sr. on American Chopper, but, you know, without the knucklehead.
And then you go and see Avatar, and you see Quartich. You know, it's like, and he's that guy, pretty much. You know, when I was watching the movie, I couldn't think about anything but him and how that's what General Ross is like. He's this older guy, and it doesn't matter that you're in the prime of youth. He'll still beat the hell out of you.
Interesting.
You know, and it's like, he's just this tough old guy. He's the John Wayne in here. You know, I assume this will segue us into True Grit in a minute. But, you know, and that's interesting because that's not me. I'm this pinko liberal pansy. But at the same time, I love that shit.
No, I'm the same way, man.
I like Westerns. I like military stuff, you know, and I can relate to that, and that's why I have a pretty easy time talking with people who I don't agree with politically, because I can find a lot of things that we actually do share in common, and that's my kind of take on Ross. Is like, you know, it's like, yeah, he's nothing like me, and that's why he's entertaining, you know, or maybe he actually is like me, and I'm just in denial. But whatever, whatever gets me into that headspace to write that character. The main things I look at when I'm writing him is just like, don't have him talk too much. You know, if he says more than like six words in a balloon, it's not him. You know, he keeps it very short, blah, blah, blah. He's the hero. Or he's the heavy.
Now, I can't remember if during Loeb's run, because I know Joe Fixit was in Loeb's run with Art Adams, and I can't remember if Joe Fixit actually ran into the Red Hulk. But after you said that, I hope that eventually we do see Joe Fixit have a conversation with the Red Hulk. Or, you know, whatever. Even I'm sure they'd be fighting when they're doing it. But
well, of course.
You know, it's...
That's how Hulk discuss things.
Let us mediate.
They have to be knocking each other across the state.
That's true. As he's picking up a boulder to hurl it at the Hulk, he says, "No, but that's the thing. That's why there's room for this Red Hulk, and no matter what happens, I think with the Green Hulk and whatever the future is, I think because he is General Ross and he does have this different voice. Another guy like you were just describing is, Colonel Ty from Battlestar Galactica, Michael Hogan.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got that kind of flinty, badass kind of, and right down to the eye patch back to True Grit. But there's something very cool about the old, you know, experienced sergeant that can get you out of the foxhole no matter what and make sure you survive.
Yeah, and another character we're introducing, General Fortean, he's somebody who served under Ross constantly with the Hulkbusters, constantly chasing the Hulk. And you kind of find out through him a little what it was like back then. It's like, yes, of course people talked about Ross behind his back. They called him Ahab, you know, because he's on this eternal quest he can't win trying to catch this whale. But, you know, as the setup in the book goes, Ross faked his own death. Banner tricked him into making it look like it was Red Hulk that killed Ross, which is kind of brilliant because now he can't ever... If he reveals himself, he destroys the one thing that's really precious to him, which is his military career. And so he can't do that. It's just way too important to him. He's always going to sit on it. And now here's this guy who wants revenge for Ross by killing the Hulk. You know, it's like all he can do is sit there and appreciate the irony while he's being shot at by all kinds of weaponry. And at the same time, though, it's different than when Hulk would face Ross, and Hulk's constant thing of, bah, puny army always coming after me with these, ground-air missiles, blah, blah, blah. Ross kind of appreciates the attack. And when Fortean will pull off a good attack, he's going to go, that was nice. You know, he can't help himself. He's in this weird position of wanting to live, but at the same time, he kind of wants Fortean to win. You know, it's that gets you another kind of facet that makes something that seems simple a little more complex, and that's the magic of a Hulk book. You know, it's like he's a brute. He's Jekyll and Hyde. Really, everybody relates to him because everybody's had their own fantasies of. Man, if I just cut loose, you all better get the hell out of here. And that's what the Hulk represents for everyone. You especially will hear it if you go work out at a gym. Someone, especially if you tell them you have something to do with comics, the first thing they will always bring up is the Hulk. They always go to the Hulk, and they talk about him. And I just sit back and listen. It's like, okay, what's your Hulk thoughts? Come on, tell me. And, they all relate to him. Because, you know, everybody's got the inside that wants to lose it and wants to just smash and destroy everything inside, the anarchy thing. And that's what Hulk is. You can never, I guess the mistake would be to nail it down to super specifics. You want to keep it just vague enough and mythic enough. And everyone will imprint on it the thing that works for them. Nail it down too much, go too much into the psychology of it. I think is a mistake.
You've got a point one issue coming up. Do you anything you can tease about that?
Yeah, that's where Fortean is introduced.
I got you. Okay, very cool. And Fear itself has been announced. I don't know if the Hulk has any direct or I've seen the Green Hulk be directly involved in that. I don't know if your book is going to be involved in that.
Yeah, it's not too early to say, but it's too spoilery to say, so I can't
say. All right, fair enough.
Same thing with the Thunderbolts.
Okay, and that's
too spoilery to say.
Okay. That's fine, and I kind of...
Why would I ruin you people's enjoyment by telling you exactly what's going on? even though people don't mind coming right in and say, what's going to happen? Like, really? Do you want me to just tell you what's going to happen? Is that fun for you? Do you want to watch your, you were watching Lost, did you want to know what was going to happen next week before you saw it?
No, but it doesn't surprise me that they asked that, because all it takes is coming in spring, Fear Itself, and you get sucks.
Immediately jumps on that, blows. Fraction had barely opened his mouth to say, what we want to do, it blows.
Exactly.
And it's like, come on now.
No shit.
Give him a damn chance. The story hasn't even started yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and by the way, it doesn't blow, because I've read the outline of it, which I'm sure will change a little bit, but it's actually kind of cool.
And
I was happy because it gives me some opportunities to do some neat stuff. So, that's all I care about is me. So, yeah.
Well, and as well you should, and it should be something as simple as an intangible idea, as you were just saying about don't get into the details so much, because then that gives you guys the chance to put your own imprint. What does Fear Itself mean to General Ross, the Red Hulk? I mean, that's and the Thunderbolts. That's what it should be. It should be that
simple.
The nice
thing is Fraction's come up with something. He's the ringleader on this, and he's come up with something that lets everybody work into it what works for them, rather than doing the thing that I think doesn't work with crossovers, where you go, okay, these characters have to do this, and
right.
And then if you come up and say, well, that doesn't make sense for my character, you know, it's like, too bad.
Right, he has to be at a certain...
You got to force a square peg into a round hole, and he's not doing that.
Right, he needs to be at this point at the end of your story. And it's like, yeah, that's great. I really wasn't planning on having him in the South Pole, but thanks.
Now they are at the South Pole. The one person who's the shining example who did something when put in that position is, of course, Walt Simonson. Shooter had everybody's got to stop what they're doing and had the Beyonder come walking through their comic and pee all over the place.
See, I'm so glad I didn't read Secret Wars 2. What happened to Walt?
Actually, it's more entertaining than that. And it's funny because I saw Shooter at a show, and I immediately geeked out and started asking him a bunch of questions like, hey, how'd that Pope comic happen? And stuff like that. I just wanted to know about how the hell did that come about? Hey, boy, he had a whole story ready to go. And it's like, but still, he was sending the Beyonder, who's against essentially this guy who's,
I know the story about the Beyonder, sure.
Clothes with a crow, right. And stuff. And everybody's got to go into everybody's comic, and I don't think Walt Simonson liked it. It was kind of clear. But yet, he used it to create that character, Curse, who was badass. And that's the big win. Whenever you can take something and an editorial mandate like that and make something cool, he really made hay with it. And I really enjoyed that. It's like, wow, he got this character in here. It kind of didn't slow him down that much. And then, bam, you know. And I always quote that Thor as, like, one of my all-time favorite superhero runs.
Oh, God, yeah. But, I just, for whatever reasons, wasn't reading it right when Secret Wars was happening, so no, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, you're all about, when's the Impossible Man getting into this?
I'm a big fan. Absolutely, man.
he'll be the game changer.
He's a green guy with kind of a sock puppet face. He's perfect. I love that guy.
It's so weird. And the weird thing that you know that at the time, you go back and read the original Fantastic Four, that I keep getting the fact that they think of him as speaking like Tony Randall. I don't know where I was getting that from.
That's interesting.
but I believe that's the truth. I don't know why.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's even better. I had no idea. So it's like he was like a Harvey Corman.
No, that could just be me. I don't mean to say, this was Tony Randall. But
that's like Kazoo. That's like Kazoo on the Flintstones being Harvey Corman. Hello, dum-dums.
Exactly. He is Kazoo, pretty much.
Oop.
We need something to get us out of our plot lines that we've used all of. Now, come on. Send a wacky little guy in.
Sorry, bud. Hold on.
A little green man.
I'm sorry. My ear thing popped out when I said he is Kazoo, so I missed whatever you were jamming on there.
Oh, Kazoo makes the ear, the canal, in such a shape.
No, it's back now. Everything's fine. So I...
I wasn't saying anything worth recording.
I'm sure something good was there, but then that's
no,
okay.
No, it was not.
Well, don't worry.
Anyway, yeah, we got the Hulk under control. Hulk's a lot of fun for me to write because coming off of Atlas and also writing Thunderbolts, which has a big cast, Hulk has a very small cast. And I'm able to like really get some quality time with like two or three characters at a time, and I love that. That's a very big switch up for me. I don't want to get too forced into doing team dynamics so that I start repeating myself.
Well, and that's interesting, Jeff, because you have been doing a lot of team books. And I didn't even realize that it's been a while since you've been able to focus on a single character like this. So,
yeah, I want just one dude walking around talking to himself in the desert. that's what the kids like.
No, there's nothing wrong with that. Well, you're doing both.
Yeah. No, and I've got a really good balance right now. Like Thunderbolts, and that one, that's my fault. I expanded that. I want this to be this whole kind of epic scale thing where we're like looking at all various just parts of this prison and all these characters, and it all has to work together. And that's working out too. And we're going to add even more characters pretty soon. But the reason, of course, they're giving us an out. We're just going to simply do more comics. So you're going to have several months where it's like, whoa, Thunderbolt ships every 2 weeks.
Oh, terrific.
And, that's the kind of thing Marvel's kind of like, well, if you want to do that, you can, because the fans, while they don't like really buying a bunch of tertiary comics, they don't mind buying something that just adds to the story they've been enjoying, at least from what everybody's been able to tell and from what they come back to us with. So, fine, I'm more than happy to write twice as many Thunderbolts as usual. And I guess the kind of the lead there is, like Ultimate Spider-Man. As always, what did Bagley do, like a comic book a week or something?
Brian
or something.
Yeah, something like, crazy. Like 18, it was definitely like 18 issues or whatever.
It's like they got into this kind of grudge match. Oh, yeah, well, I can write 3 issues a month. Oh, yeah, well, I'll draw 3 issues a month. This thing might. And then I would look back and it's like, my God, how long has this run been going on? That's only been 2 years.
Like, we've got 100 comics. That's great.
We've got 100 issues.
No, you're right. And, I want to go back to the beginning because you came in on the Thunderbolts and have taken them into a different direction. And I was never a big Thunderbolts reader. I appreciated what Busiek did.
I was also not.
It's an interesting gimmick, but it just wasn't for me. And I didn't give a shit about the Masters of Evil. And, I like Red Hood, or rather Baron Zemo Jr., but, he's not his father, but it's still an interesting character. And I like even what Bruce's doing right now with him and everything. Regardless, You've taken it in a completely different direction, and you've got Luke in charge of this team, but sometimes he's not there. And also, you've picked an interesting group of villains that I've suddenly give a shit about. And that solo issue of the Ghost that just happened a couple weeks ago is a prime example of that. What a dickish character in Iron Man, but you've made him a much more interesting and even sympathetic character, I think, in this secret origin of the Ghost.
Yeah, and I was, of course, trepidatious about that. I was worried, it's kind of like telling Boba Fett's origins, like, he was a big mystery man, and once you nail him down, that's it, though there's, no guarantee Ghost is that reliable a narrator, but I'm not going to lie too much about you. Something in there is true. I'm not going to waste your time for 22 pages telling you something that wasn't true. So there's truth in there. There may be more truth.
Interesting.
But anyway, the whole thing with that, I thought, well, it would be nice to kind of show everybody, it's like Ghost is the villain you could end up being. One, you're all computer programmers. I can tell that from the message boards. So, this is what would happen to you once you start to get taken advantage of by the man. You're going to become this kind of withdrawn, creepy character one day, and here's the path. But, that's the thing. When your job is to tell the villain's story, they're the heroes. So that's what I wanted to do with that.
Well, and does that also include that when we get screwed by the man, we'll get a hot chick to manipulate us and
exactly the bosses will make one of the employees sleep with you to keep you happy in your job, and that's the way business works. And if you don't like it, then you're not paying attention to American capitalism.
I was going
to
say that's my favorite John Houseman Smith Barney commercial from the '80s. At Smith Barney, we position girls to sleep with our employees.
To produce the best results for our stockholders.
No,
John Houseman was all about. What a weird thing for that guy to end up in that kind of position on the paper chase and everything.
It was perfect. Come on, Kingsfield, man. He milked the hell out of it. Like 20 years, he was Professor Kingsfield.
Oh, yeah. I don't think he ever took that coat off.
And then you hear all the cool Orson Welles stories about him and Welles, and eventually, too, how much they hated each other.
Well, yeah. It is kind of like a Klaus Kinski sort of thing.
back to our talk about Thunderbolts, though. I want let's go honestly back to the beginning. Was there an edict in terms of where to take this team in a different direction coming off of Ellis? And I mean, I know Remender had the fun little Danny Rand Luke story as well.
Yeah.
Before you got going, but yeah.
Yes, Tom Brevoort and Bill Roseman. When Bill asked me, he goes, "What do you think about writing the Thunderbolts?" I'm like, I don't know. Never really read them that much, and they said, "Well, here's the kind of thing we've been discussing that we want to go with. We want to base it around the raft, and we want to have more prison stuff." And initially, I was like, "Screw that!" You know, I was like, "Yeah, I am not writing a prison drama." And then I realized, it's like, wait a second. Once I'm in there, what can they do? I'll pretty much be able to fake my way through this and still get them out on missions. And of course, everybody expected them to be on missions anyway. I can't keep them in prison all day.
Right.
So it never actually ended up being. It was a worry I had for no reason. And to come to find out, no one really expected it of me anyway. They just wanted the prison as the backdrop, but they do want the prison to be like a character. And actually, I probably put the prison in there more than they even expected me to, because it's become a nice sort of thing. It's like, well, this way we've got to really flesh out how things work at the raft. Got to make a much bigger character out of Walker, the warden of the prison, formerly
yep.
U.S. agent. You know, I maimed the hell out of him in wrapping up the last Thunderbolts run. But then bring him back immediately as, well, it's like he's this badass who can jump up with only two limbs and still beat up everybody. and that's another case where here's this character, clearly doesn't vote like I do, but you know what? I'm gonna bother to spend some time and kind of give him some dignity and stuff, because it's like, you know, they're not my little message puppets to put around and do as whatever I want. What matters more is whether people are entertained or not. You know, I'm not trying to convince you to vote like me or think like me or anything. I just want you to go, wow, I really enjoyed myself while reading that.
No,
or at least get fired up, and you have to stand around and at the comic shop and talk about it to people.
Well, and another great scene in the Avengers crossover in 150 was Thor going past the women cons, and all of them go, yeah, come on
yeah,
over here, Blondie.
Yeah, you're going to be Thor when we have sex.
That's right, sex.
How could I not use that joke?
That was fantastic.
No, that was the... that's been our kind of running thing, is that the worst part of the prison is the women's ward. And if you go into the courtyard with the women, if you're a guy, you just might as well hang it up. You are going to get abused. And, Cage found out the hard way. And, that's the only thing I think Kev didn't play up quite the way I did it in the script, because I really wanted... He made Cage look like he felt bad about doing it, and I really wanted it like Cage is like, I'm going to make Thor have to go through this. And that's really what he's doing there. He's like, hey, yeah, you can talk to Gunna the Troll. Yeah, come on over here. We'll just go through the women's section. And he knows damn well what's going to happen when they walk in there. The women are going to be all just... saying a bunch of crude ass crap that Thor's just turning blushing and everything, you know, it's like they're all talking about what they want to do to Thor, and not in the usual prison sense, but sort of.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's like, yeah, that's one of my favorite things with this is I think I've got a subtly kind of approach the idea that Luke Cage has a sense of humor. And, you know, Bendis does that. He does it, but I'm trying to, like, kind of play it from a slightly different angle. And, you know, and Cage will say a few things. It's like, and then you kind of realize later, well, Cage was making a joke. All of Cage's jokes, in my mind, have to sink in. They shouldn't be that obvious. It should be later, oh, yeah, Cage was screwing with me. There's or a, whatever, just because you don't expect him to.
There's a glint of Lee Marvin in Cage, and you know, obviously Lee Marvin in the Dirty Dozen.
A little bit, and at the same time, Cage is just...
he's still Cage, don't get me wrong, man.
He's still Cage. I feel like to write him correctly, you have to acknowledge his kind of exploitation roots.
Sure.
If you just treat him like, you know, no, he's just a guy who happens to be named Luke Cage, you're not... I don't know. It's even if you don't like what they did in the 70s to introduce him or whatever, I still think you have to address it in some way, or you still have to kind of do nods towards it.
It's
you know, Ari's not Luke Cage. That's just who he was. When he showed up, he was wearing a chain and a tiara and had a big fro. And it's like...
But
our costume kind of acknowledges a little bit of his old costume.
Right.
You know, he's got these big gauntlets that he uses to control the nanites and the prisoners and everything. And it's more of a uniform. That was the one thing we were all in accordance on. We were like, let's let Cage have a bit of a superhero uniform again. You know, at least when he's doing the Thunderbolt stuff. The rest of the time, maybe he feels like, yeah, I'm just wearing my shirt and this untucked shirt and everything. But, you know, during that... or whatever, he's going to a prison job. He's got to look a little even harder than usual. You know, he doesn't let down his guard around them because he knows the way the world of the prison works. Like, you don't go in and try to be their buddy. And Cage is generally always on. He's never being nice, and when he is being nice, it's a special thing.
Well, and I think, too, he's got that same attitude that I think Avery Brooks brought to Hawk, the Robert Parker character from the Spencer novels.
Oh, and I love Avery Brooks.
And from the TV series, exactly, because yeah. He did have that tinge of exploitation, as you say, but also was still a modern guy and was more than, you know, just a guy off the street. I mean, he clearly had brains and you know, could handle himself, but wasn't just Shaft. I mean, he really... He was Shaft with an education. How he got that education is another thing. But yeah, he's not a knucklehead that can only think beyond, you know, at the street level, and that's all.
Yeah, Cage is great because you can downplay things with him and get a lot of stuff happening with him or whatever just by the way you handle him. So he's a joy to write.
And the man thing, obviously,
he's man thing.
Well, exactly.
How can you not have the man thing
when you first announced the roster? That was the thing. It was, you know, you're naming people off and man thing, and it's like, hey, man thing, wait a minute, back up a second. That's
awesome.
Yeah,
for that you can thank Bill Roseman. I think at one of the editorial meetings they were talking about. I want to say Joe probably wanted man thing on something, and then they ended up not using him there. And then Bill, while everybody was, you know, taking a drink of coffee or something, said, can we use him in Thunderbolts or something like that? You know, just went ahead. Knowing damn well I'm going to want to use him. You know, he's not even having to worry about whether that's going to happen or not, of course.
Fantastic.
And, you know, they said, yeah, Thunderbolts. I don't know how he'd do that. And of course, then I immediately went to, you know, I wanted to work in the stuff Dan Slott had been doing with Hank Pym and everything like that. You know, poor little Hank Pym, he only comes on for like two pages, but he gets a great scene where he sets up this whole thing that determines how the Thunderbolts travel around the world. And it's such a ludicrous concept, but you don't not accept it. You go along with it because, of course, they're going to go down in a habitat that's a swamp underneath the prison. And they and go with this monster all over the world. How else would they get there? You know, it makes perfect sense.
Well, and that
but
was...
it's fine because as much as I like it, you know, and it's obvious in the Hulk how much I like military hardware and keep writing it in. I just don't want to spend all this time having to explain how they get to the plane and how they go everywhere. Blah blah blah. So Man Thing killed two birds one stone for me. One, he gets the man thing in there because he's man thing. And then he gets everybody everywhere. And actually, we've kind of played it up so that he's not only really a teleporter the way they use him, he's the best teleporter. It's like, you know, almost no magic or anything can keep him out. Because, you know, I'm building back on the whole Steve Gerber Nexus of Reality stuff from the original comic books. you know, he's made out of this swamp, which is this whole gateway to the rest of the multiverse.
That's what was so much fun, that frog character that you came up with for 150 was really what an interesting character.
I was surprised how many people were upset that frog died.
Well, I was going to say, I almost wonder if you kind of, you know, who knows what I guess happened after the squish or before the squish. But, yeah, I think you kind of came up with something that might have had a life beyond his frogger-like demise.
Yeah. Oh, well, because, you know.
Game over.
That's an interesting thing where Kev Williams, Kev Walker, Kev Williams, the hell am I talking about? Kev Walker proposed another way for him to die based on what he felt like drawing.
Okay.
And Kev does that a lot because Kev's a writer and Kev's a good cartoonist. And, you know, if he's got an idea, I generally, unless I really had very strong feelings about the way it had to go down, I'll generally go with what his instincts are because he's not wrong. And I originally, if you go back and look at the beginning of that issue, you'll see this big lizard-looking prisoner walking around. He's standing there when all the Avengers come walking out, and they're all shouting, catcalling at him. And at the end, I was going to have him be the one who just kind of snaps up the toad and just eats him. That was just going to be it. But then Kev thought, this is good story instincts, Kev thought it took away having all these extraneous characters around at the end. He wanted to just have the core characters. And he also thought, and this is a hard thing to pull off, he thought it would work better if a door slamming shut just smashed that frog. And not a lot of people would do that because that's actually not an easy thing to depict in a drawing. Because it's the kind of thing live action, yes, makes a lot of sense, but it's a little hard. You got to do the 1-2 shot in a comic book to make it clear.
Uh-huh.
And do some motion lines and everything. But he did it perfectly. It reads exactly as what it is, and that poor little frog is clearly not existing in any form after that. Worst decision of his life was to come into our universe. I like the idea that he's just out there fishing and everything. And you know, I wanted to show, this is one of the things where I got to stack the deck a little and show how Luke Cage deals with normal people or the average folks better than anyone else can. Even Steve Rogers, who, you know, generally is like, oh, whatever you got to do, Steve Rogers does that the best. But, you know, even he wasn't the best. Certainly Tony Stark isn't. Tony Stark immediately starts making demands like, we need to find these characters, blah, 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 and the frog just doesn't have anything to do with him. And then Luke just goes up and introduces himself like a human being. You know, and then the frog's like, oh, okay, somebody's got some manners here, I'll tell you. And, you know, and that's the kind of thing I think it's fun to do with a character like him.
It was a great issue, and the difference, the way the Thunderbolts handled things, the way the Avengers were handling things, it was a great team-up. And, again, now you had a lot of pages for that story. For the Ghost story, you had, you know, was it a standard 22?
Oh, yeah, that was regular. Yeah, I had – that was a 40-page story for the special.
Right. Okay. There you go. And to your credit, too, because there's some 40-page stories that sometimes are lacking, and you put a lot of story into there. So I don't know, man. I hand it to you. You did it again. And what's coming up? What can you tell us about what's coming up for the Thunderbolts?
You may have seen me doing a bit of a stunt online where I'm asking people who they'd like to be a Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
In fact, I've had to go back and read that because we left a write-in option. So I know Marvel's got a lot of things when everybody gets back in the office to show me or what people wrote. Because I'm not tricking everybody. I really am going to take their notes into consideration and who people are asking for. I wasn't expecting all the shocker love. That's not what I saw coming. But you know, if that's who they want, by God, the shocker is going to figure in somehow. Also, Madam Mask and some others.
I kind of figured Madam Mask might be something that you have in your back pocket, just given your past with her as well.
And then it's almost like they wanted to thwart me by not voting for Mr. Hyde. And like, you know what? You know who's the writer of this book? Me.
Oh, so that's your pet.
I want Mr. Hyde in there. Mr. Hyde's going in.
I got no problem with that.
But actually, I've got, you know, you'll find out soon enough. But anyway, I'm going to take a lot of that reader input in. So I think a lot of people are going to be a little excited to see the way we handle it. And you'll be seeing that some more. And like I said, we're going to have we're going to have more issues than normal. And
Are Kevin Declan going to be?
Declan Shalvey is going to come in and kind of take up the slack.
Fantastic.
So you'll still have plenty of Kev Walker, and if you like Declan Shalvey, you're in business too, because
Yay.
He's going to be doing a lot.
We do like Declan Shalvey, so
and
that's
I'm
going
to try to convince them not to take other jobs, because screw other books. They need to just be doing the Thunderbolts all the time. Anyway, I just feel like we're in a really good run, and I just want to keep it going for quite a while, because I remember what it was like to be a reader, and when I hit on a book, like, at a magic time, it's like, oh, a lot of things have come together in just the right way to make things work in this book. And luckily, I've stumbled upon it right as it started, you know, and I would get excited about that. And, you know, I'd be in every Wednesday, you know, waiting for that. And so, you know, I realize that's happening with Thunderbolts, and believe me, I'm going to keep those good times rolling as long as I can.
That's fantastic. Has the response from the fans? I mean, is it selling okay? I mean, you know.
Yeah, it sells fine.
Good, because obviously, I mean, that is the concern. So many great, I mean, this has been the year of, you know, Atlas and Thor the Mighty Avenger, and you had it last year with Mysterious over at Wildstorm and stuff. I mean, great ideas that I think, you know, become these critical darlings and don't get big numbers because of the magnitude of the events that are happening around them. So,
yeah, like Hulk was already selling really well. You know, it was coming off Loeb and McGinnis. Their
yeah,
big
how,
name.
How is that change? Because you guys are a
it's
different
still selling
team.
Well. Yeah,
fantastic.
It's like I think everybody was worried. They're like, oh, man, what's this going to be like? Well, it didn't drop any more than anything else across the board dropped because of the economy. You know, we're right on numbers, so we're
Excellent.
Doing fine.
Okay, very good.
Let me think. Yeah, Thunderbolt's still doing great. You know,
cool.
So those books are, for once, I don't have to worry. It's nice to be able to not have to rush a story or in the case of, like, and not necessarily rush it, but like in Atlas, if I'd known I had had another year to do something, what I would have done is I would have spaced in some more plot threads and had things wind around before they resolved themselves. Instead, I just didn't introduce those extra plot threads. You know, I just went ahead, okay, we're just going to tell the story with these elements that we've got in action now. So the things in play will be all that's in play. And but, you know, with something like Hulk and Thunderbolts, it's like, okay, I'm going to seed some stuff, and there's going to be a little bit of time before you get to the payoff because I've got the luxury of doing it. And it's the kind of thing as a reader I appreciate and look forward to, like, oh, when are they going to get back to that moment? And it's like, I remember it. I haven't forgotten it. Has the writer forgotten it? You know, you keep wondering about that.
Well, and again, I think you guys, I think Remender is in this position currently as well. Paul Tobin in a lot of ways. You guys are great writers and stuff. And it just, because of the giant events around you, it's tough to get someone to take a chance on a book that isn't part of the big story. And I understand that from a general soap opera standpoint, but, you know, it's, guys miss a lot of cool, and women as well, miss a lot of cool books that come and go and aren't given a chance to breathe. And obviously, as we said, if this were the 80s, some of this stuff would have given gotten more of a chance to survive longer. But
if it were the 80s, just imagine the numbers on these things. It would have been crazy. I would be running around buying used cars when I blow a head gasket in my Grand Cherokee. I would just be going straight to the dealership going, what's new? Actually, I wouldn't, because that's not kind of car freak I am. That's what I've been dealing with lately. It's like I blew a head gasket, and then I had to go looking on Craigslist going, crap, what am I going to find? And like, I got to find something good for a family to drive around.
My man, I know. Believe me, my Christmas has been my car hanging by a thread. I understand.
That's why on Twitter I was asking everybody about cars the other day, because I had already bought it at that point. But in my head, I just couldn't get off cars. All I wanted to talk about was cars. So I was just like, hey, let's stop talking about whatever internet show or blah, blah, some geek thing, and let's talk about something we all can we can all share or whatever. That's why I was asking everybody what car they drove. It's like, I was genuinely curious. You know, I write these things into scripts, and it's like, you know, what are you all driving? Apparently, everybody's driving a lot of Hondas. It's a big Honda crowd.
I'll throw the Honda, man. Good car, man. I was
on
Nissan.
Twitter, they are good cars. They're very reliable. I was getting to go through and see a few things comics readers are into. They're into Japanese cars, apparently. So that's what we're going to draw into the comics in the future.
That's hilarious.
And hey, so good product placement. You know, I just got this. I got a killer deal on this old Volvo station wagon that I really liked. It was a turbo, and you know, it only had a couple of things wrong with it. I've already fixed them.
Good.
So. Yeah, that's my little thing, because I occasionally have to go out. I have to either do that or work on the house or something to get out of headspace all the time.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that what you do?
It's not good for you.
Understood. No, and that makes sense.
I genuinely believe it is not good to be in your head as much as people in comics or various creative industries are.
No, I think you're right about that, and I think it's funny. I just earlier I was talking to Brad Meltzer. And I think your brain needs to focus on, not focus on something else, but, yeah, something simple. And that's, I think it allows you to relax and let the ideas kind of creep in, as opposed to kind of just staring at the blank screen and going, come on, think.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm with you on that.
I'm trying to remember the cartoonist. I want to say it was Bill Everett, but I might be wrong. It seems like it was Bill Everett. Somebody used to have their... I remember reading this article in one of the, Amazing Heroes or something years ago, talking about how his wife would be on him, like, go in there and sit down and work. And he would be tiling the bathroom and going, I am working. And I know what he was talking about. He's like, while I'm doing this thing, while I'm out mowing the yard or whatever and making this white noise, stuff's coming to me.
Yep.
And it's like, and when I'm sitting there in front of a typewriter or a computer now, you know, and it's not. You feel like, oh, my God, I'm wasting precious time. I'm not making something happen. When really, a lot of time, what you need to do is just sit there, figure out, state the problem in your head. You know, I need blah, blah, blah. I need this sort of thing to start happening. Here's all the characters I have in play. It's not coming to you. Go do something else. Go ride your bike or whatever. Like I said, I see Bendis riding his bike around town all the time. I ride my bike around. And a lot of the cartoonists down at Periscope Studio do. And while you're out there peddling or mowing or working on something, your subconscious will just do the work for you. It'll just start turning away. And then I had one day, it was one summer day, I was trying to mow the yard, and I swear to God, I'd get out, I'd mow for 20 minutes, and I'd have to run back inside and write down all the stuff that came to me. And it took me like 5 hours to mow the yard. But man, I had like most of a script done by the end of the day. It was it was really exciting. I was just like, every time I go do this, the white noise thing, I also used to get ideas from driving big distances. Like, I'd drive across country, and I'd figure out whole storylines doing that. I think a lot of The Inner Man I wrote that way. It's just it's that weird thing where you're in that zone, and you're out there, and your brain gets into that certain state. And then it lets things start flowing as if you're being told the story. And that's really a good way to work. If you can count on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, then you're going to say, well, I don't know where it's coming from. And, yeah, I guess that's obviously the origin of the idea of a muse, you know, in ancient mythology.
Certainly.
And that's the thing. You also, I have my superstitions about it. It's like, I'm not going to ignore the muse. I'm not going to not write this down. And if I get an idea in the middle of the night, I'll wake up and start typing it or jot it down in some unreadable scrawl on a piece of paper next to the bed, because I feel like, no, you can't ever say, I'll remember that, because I've woken up plenty of times going, I don't remember all that. It made perfect sense at 3 a.m.
Yeah, you're throwing away million-dollar ideas that way.
Yeah, you're throwing money out the window.
Truly, I understand.
And you don't want to do that. Your brain just saved you some work. You could go ahead and be putting that down. I don't know how many times I've got up in the middle of the night and written down a few pages just because they came to me.
Well, I want to talk about a couple more things, and one of them is, I guess you have a webcomic coming up?
Yes.
Talk about that. I had
Bucko,
no idea.
And I'm working with Erica Moen, a cartoonist known for a comic Dar.
All right.
As in Gaydar.
Oh, very nice. Gaydar.
It could be as in the Daughters of the American Revolution, but I don't think so. It was a very sexually explicit strip she did. Surprisingly, lots of fans. And, you know, and then one day Erica came up to me and just said, would you want to work with me on something? I went, well, of course. Wow, that'd be neat. And then we started babbling it over. And then I started actually getting some ideas just based on observing Erica, because she's just in the studio all the time, and I'm there. It's kind of weird. I sort of did this with Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics when I wrote the series Walk-In for Virgin Comics.
Okay.
I don't know if you ever read that. I need to send it to you.
No, I remember when you took over Gamekeeper, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did. But before that, I did this thing called Walk-In.
Okay.
And it was called Dave Stewart's Walk-In.
Of course, yeah.
God forbid you name it after the person who wrote everything.
Well, and I don't even remember who Gamekeeper originally was, and I know it was a filmmaker.
Guy Ritchie.
Okay, there you
Guy
go.
Guy Ritchie.
Yeah. So go on.
Boy, me and Andy Diggle, they're going to cut us in for all the big bucks should that ever hit it to the big screen. You can guarantee it. There's no way they'd forget us.
I'm sure you guys are waiting at the bus stop. That's all right.
Yeah, we're like, boy, can I go ahead and just spend this money before it gets...
So the Dave Stewart comic, yeah.
Before that, they had asked... they had talked to me about doing a thing. It's like, well, we're doing these kind of series with... various creators from other industries, and do you know Dave Stewart? I went, you mean of the Eurythmics? Yes, of course. Not Dave Stewart, the colorist, who does Hellboy, who's also excellent.
He's cool too.
He's very good, and of course Darwin stuff.
Yeah.
And so they arranged a call, and you know, he calls up. Sounds just like Ringo. I swear to God, you're talking to him. And he's like, "Hello, Jeff." You know, so I was like, "We're just having a little wine," and blah blah blah. And he's just babbling on, I barely understand him. But the whole time, I'm just sitting there picturing the video for Sweet Dreams Are Made of This with him and Annie Lennox. And, yeah, so it doesn't really matter what he says. I'm just watching this video from 20 years ago in my head. And, you know, and he starts telling me a story about, he was actually going into a very different story than what we ended up with. He was telling me the story of this Mr. Memory thing. But then he started. He was talking about the inspirations came from him as this kind of young entertainer and going to Berlin and playing around Europe and stuff like that. And this kind of little thing he would do to warm up a crowd. And then I just started basing the characters like vaguely on him. And then I kind of created this kind of heroic woman figure, who in my mind was essentially just Annie Lennox. Like, well, Annie Lennox was kind of your superhero. She was this Scottish woman with this amazing set of pipes who could just belt out lyrics like you couldn't believe. And Dave Stewart was very talented too, but, you know, it's like obviously everyone thought of her whenever sure. They thought of the Eurythmics. And I kind of just turned that into a comic book and somehow ended up setting it in Russian with all the strippers and these people from another dimension with octopuses on their back. And, you know, it's comics.
Sure.
And that's the sort of way that worked out. And I've kind of been using that same approach with Erica, where it's like she's going to get self-conscious eventually if she's capable of it, because she'll say something, do something, and then the next week I'll give her a script where that thing has been translated into comics form in some way. Through another character's voice, she's like, "Good grief, you're just using everything I'm doing." I'm like, "Yeah, I feel like that's the way I can keep this flavor that's very you in here." And then when you draw it, you're going to bring something extra to it. It's a really neat way to work, and we're kind of working one page at a time. I send her the script, she draws it, and then I move on. And probably in February or March, we're going to finally launch the webcomic.
Okay.
And it'll be very different from what you expected for me, because once I've got all the freedom in the world to do whatever I want, so I'm not bound by bad words or whatever things I can't say in a Marvel comic.
Good.
And you know, and also it's kind of interesting because it's going to come out around the same time of this American Film Channel show of Portlandia that Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein are doing.
I don't know anything about it. American Film Channel? I don't know that.
Look this up. Did you see the video for Portland Dream of the 90s?
No.
Oh, you're going to love this. Okay, well, it just put Fred Armisen, Carrie Brownstein in.
Okay.
It'll come up the first thing in Google. And they made this video that's going to be, I assume, a big part of the show. The whole show is set in the mythical city of Portland, Oregon, where of course, I live.
Yes.
And... Except they're not really making any of this up. This is actually the way Portland is. You know, you can go to the website and you can see little clips of the kind of stuff they're going to do, and they're pretty spot on. I think Fred Armisen probably lived here for a little while. She's from here. I see her in the coffee shop that I go to every now and then. She'll come by. She's about to go walk her dogs or something. I think her family lives in the neighborhood. She comes in. And I never bug her about it because I feel like, oh, this would be kind of weird. She's just trying to get some coffee. you know, she was in the band Sleater-Kinney, if you ever followed them.
Okay.
And Fred Armisen is the funniest guy on Saturday Night Live in the last 15 years.
Yeah, I'm a fan. Absolutely.
Yeah, I love Fred Armisen. God, that guy's so funny. So anyway, they did this video called Portland, Dream of the 90s, where he comes up and he kind of, like, he finds her in L.A. and he sort of explains to her, I've just been somewhere. You remember how we had all these dreams about you just wanted to get tribal tattoos and not work very much and just go do whatever? There's a place where that dream's still alive. And then they start going into Portland, and then the rest of the video is shot in Portland out on the Esplanade in front of the Willamette River, and you see all the kind of freaks that you expect to see in Portland, people on tall bikes and stuff like that, clowns.
People singing for their lunch, literally, and getting a free meal just as long as they sing for a sandwich.
Yeah, it's all very Portlandy stuff, and I was like, wow, this is kind of weird because this show is going to come out the same time we're going to put this webcomic, and this webcomic is extremely Portland. Like, everybody rides bikes in the comic.
Very nice.
And that's just basically because Erica and I ride bikes. So it's just this weird thing where our auto-bio stuff is filtered into comic form. And you meet this guy who's called Bucko essentially because Erica called her brother that on the phone one time when I was listening. And this guy goes for a job, and you realize when he's at the interview, he's got diarrhea, and he's about to lose it right there, and all he can do is just with tears in his eyes ask for a bathroom key and go running down the hall. And fumbling with the key, trying desperately to get in, and opens the door and finds a dead body with a knife sticking out of the neck when he gets in there.
All right.
And this whole scenario was based on a thing I brought up like back in 2005 into the studio that I came up with on my bike ride, and I came walking in, and I remember asking David Hahn and Steve Lieber this, where I said, okay, here it is. You know, you get hit with one of those things, you've got to get to the bathroom immediately. You go fumbling in over there, you burst in there, and there's a dead body on the floor. That doesn't mean you still don't have to go. And everybody acknowledged, yeah, I'd probably sit down and finish what I ran in there for, despite the dead body I had to walk over.
Sure.
And the whole story starts from that point. And then we kind of work our way backwards, and you end up seeing, like, this party, this kind of thing he was at the night before and all this stuff. And it's a very rambling, in a way it's a little bit like the way I wrote Mysterious, The Unfathomable, where it's a bunch of threads that start weaving together in weird ways, and it really, you're going to think, he's high, there's no story here. And then you eventually figure out, oh, okay, it actually is a story, it's just kind of unconventional, more kind of Big Lebowski sort of style.
Okay.
But that's what it's going to be like, and Erica is just killing it on this. She's working so hard on these pages, and they're hilarious. I think it's going to be huge. And it's weird because, you know, it's not hasn't been my thing yet. I haven't done a webcomic yet, but, you know, the way we're just completely indulging ourselves, I think people will get caught up in the spirit of it as much as we are, I hope.
And it'll be weekly? Will it be daily?
It should be two or three times a week. We're still trying to figure that out.
Okay.
Yeah, we want it to be a nice regular thing where you go in and get your fix, you know.
Will you post it at your blog, or will you just link to it from your blog?
I will refer link to the main site, yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
And of course, on Twitter, I'll constantly be sending everybody there. It's going to be something. It'll be something very different. It'll be a refreshing change from superheroes flying around.
Okay, we'll stop there. That's part one of our conversation with Jeff Parker. But we're not done here at Word Balloon. In fact, now we switch to our other feature that's beginning this week, the Word Balloon Hotline. I've been throwing out possible conversation topics on Twitter and Facebook and asking for your contributions, and we've got a few of those today. But let us go over some of the answers we've gotten today. If you want to call the Word Balloon Hotline, give me your 2 cents. Any questions or suggestions about the show, or direct comments regarding past guests. Feel free to call me 312-841-7025. 312-841-7025. The number also is at wordballoon.com, and you are given up to 3 minutes to comment. So without further ado, let's take our first call.
Hey, John, I think the show's awesome, man. I just want to know when are we going to ever get a Grant Morrison interview. Love the show, man. Enjoy. Thanks.
Well, thank you. Grant Morrison is someone I would love to talk to again. I had a brief video interview with him while I was working at Newsarama at the New York Comic Con in 2008. And ever since then, got his contact information. I have emailed a few times. I haven't gotten a response back. But I'm hoping to talk to Grant again in a longer conversation, because he is one of my favorite writers, just like many of yours. And it would be great to talk to him again. Let's hear who else is on the line.
John, Jesse Jackson from Dallas, Texas, was at the Brad Meltzer signing yesterday, and I mentioned how much I enjoyed your interview with him, and he had many kind things to say about you and the podcast, and told the standing room only crowd that they should check out your podcast and hear great entertainment, and I had to echo it. Always enjoy listening to the podcast, and keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thanks, Jesse, and thanks for saying something to Brad. Thank you all, because not the first time that I've heard from a caller or listener or creator that one of you have gone up to one of the creators at either a book signing or a convention and said that you've heard the Word Balloon interviews. That's fantastic. Thank you very much. And I saw Brad last Friday in Chicago at his book signing for the Inner Circle. He's doing great, and I've been enjoying Decoded. Good news, there are two more new episodes as of this taping that still have to air for the first season, and he is close to hearing whether or not Decoded will be renewed for a second season on the History Channel. So good luck to Brad. And also, we've talked before about his Heroes for My Son books. He announced that he's signing that he has a new book out coming out next year called Heroes for My Daughters. So the women get the equal treatment, and I think that's terrific. On to the next question.
Hello, John Suntress. This is Scott Hines from Fanboy Radio. My opinion of Anne Hathaway and Catwoman and Tom Hardy as Bane is I'm so excited! It's going to be really good. There's going to be lots of drugs because Bane is going to be in it, and there's going to be lots of leather on Anne Hathaway.
Well, that's great. Now, you see, I used to call Fanboy Radio back in the day, and now Scott Hines has called Word Balloon. Very nice. No, it's good to hear from Scott, and next time I would say don't mix NyQuil with aspirin, and you might have better luck in the morning and more cogent thoughts. But no, I agree with you. I'm very excited about Tom Hardy and Anne Hathaway being in the new Batman movie, and I trust Chris Nolan. I think more than the Oscars apparently trust Chris Nolan. How that guy was not nominated for Best Director for Inception makes no sense. I think Christopher Nolan, along with Darren Aronofsky and anyone else you can think of great directors of the last 20 years, Chris Nolan has to be in the top 10 of everybody's best director list of the last 20 years, because every one of his films are incredibly fascinating, his techniques are interesting, he writes incredibly provocative stories. I just don't get it. Who's on the line next?
Yes, John. This is, my name's Jeremy. I'm calling from St. Pete, Florida. I'm 36. Huge fan of your show. I discovered it back in 08 at some point, probably from Newsarama. I think that's where I found it the first time and discovered your Bendis tapes and just, fell in love with your show. Would love to fucking have a bunch of beer with you, not just a beer with you. I'm so tired of that shit. I want to have a bunch of beers with you at some time. So hopefully you come down to do a MegaCon at some point. That would be great. I know you did an FF show and we're disappointed in it, but Maybe this year. I don't know what you're doing on the circuit. But anyway, regardless, I think one of the greatest interviews you ever did, and I'd love to see you kind of put your favorite ones up on the front, is the Neil Adams interview. Your Neil Adams interview, your Denny O'Neill interview, unbelievable. I love the stuff you do with Ed Brew and Matt Fraction as well. As, of course, you and Brian are just unbelievable, and you guys should maybe once a month do a podcast show. something like Kevin Smith's Modcast or something like that. But anyway, I just got to say, man, your show rocks, and you know, I'm going to keep listening. And if you could, at some point, maybe categorize and put together, like, the Bendis tapes and group it so it's all there, you know, all the Fraction tapes and all the Brew tapes, all in one nut. Take care, man.
Thanks, Jeremy. You know, if I heard you correctly, you were saying that I didn't have a good time at the FX conventions. Not true. I had a great time. Both times I came down for the FX conventions in Orlando. I just haven't been invited since. And they had one in the fall that, you know, actually, I had heard maybe that it was canceled. I'm not sure. MegaCon was always kind of tough just because the just timing of the year. I would love to go down. Obviously, it's a great time to get out of the cold and go to Orlando. And I do hope to get back down to Orlando, and we'll try to make time every year. I'm like, God, I got to get down for MegaCon. It is the first big con of the year. And so many great people end up going to that con, and I know it's a good time. So I hope to meet you at one of these conventions, and we can have many beers together. Thank you very much.
Hey, John Schellengates. I just saw your tweet about comics and the Comics Code Authority and wanted to say that I felt it was actually a really good move on DC's part to abandon it. I'm actually pretty happy with that decision. But anyway, it's neither here nor there. Take care.
How about that? First pro calling up. That was very nice of Sterling. And it's been far too long. I know DC is holding back and not letting us know what Sterling's next assignment is. Once that is public, I hope to have Sterling back for a new conversation on Word Balloon. Got to congratulate him and Jamal Igel for such a wonderful run on Supergirl. A lot of clarity and consistency brought back to the Girl of Steel through the hands of Jamal and Sterling. And really look forward to see what Sterling has coming next.
Hi, John. Long-time listener of Word Balloon. Just saw your tweet about asking for comments on the demise of the Comic Code Authority and asking for comments. Well, basically, I'll put it as simply as I can. I think it's a way, way overdue. If you've ever read the 10-Cent Plague, which documents the terrible events that happened in the 50s that caused the authority to come into existence in the first place. You know how basically it is completely undeserving of being in existence in the first place. I think that it long outlived its usefulness pretty much as it started. Consider the fact of when you had a number of just foolish events, like Marv Wolfman almost not getting a credit, you know, because his name was Wolfman. Or the classic of when the government asked Marvel Comics and Stan Lee to put out an anti-drug comic. Ooh, can't do that. I know that it changed and updated, but it was always behind the times. And it really was designed to protect children from a non-existent threat. Anyway, good riddance to bad rubbish, I say. Anyway, keep up the great work. Thank you for doing such an amusing podcast.
Thanks. Everything that was said about, you know, the Comics Code going away, I obviously agree. I did read The 10-Cent Plague, and it's an excellent book. David Hodgew's book, if you haven't read it or listened to it. It's also an Audible book, an audio book. But, yeah, everything that was said there was absolutely true. In addition to that, listen to my interview with Neil Adams that was mentioned by another caller earlier, and check out what he had to say about the famous Speedy heroin cover from Green Lantern Green Arrow back in the day. And, you know, you can see how the Comics Code Authority was even being, you know, messed with and, you know, circumvented by the publishers 40 years ago. So, in fact, in that Neil Adams interview, he even points out another code violation in that he drew parodies of Spiro Agnew and Richard Nixon. And those were comic code violations. And they were able to get away with it. So,
yeah, I mean, the code has become kind of obsolete. I don't think parents even understand what it means when they see it, if they, you know, have a microscope to check when it's been on comics in the last few years. So it is outmoded. I'm glad to see the publishers kind of coming up with their own solutions to rate the books and let people know what's safe for kids and what aren't. But by the same token, you know, comics are a medium, not a specific, you know, media, and should not have the restrictions, just like books shouldn't have restrictions, films, television. There should be comic books for every type of age group. Okay, you hear my voice getting weaker, so I'm going to wrap it up. Don't forget to call the Word Balloon Hotline with any questions or comments that you have. Call 312-841-7025. Thanks again for listening to this episode of Word Balloon. It was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. There's a lot of great value waiting for you there, from 38% to 52% off the standard retail price. All shipping on orders of $50 or more, it's free shipping at InStockTrades.com. Check out all the details for yourself, InStockTrades.com. All right, so I'm going to wrap up. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2011. Take care, everybody.